there's two lenses, for example. Put an object out in front of one. You're looking in from this direction. And what do you see? You see an image. So what you do is you take and forget the second image. The light goes through the first image, it produces an image. I mean, it goes through the first lens, it produces an image. Okay? Then you use that image as an object for the second lens. And you do the same thing when you're writing down the equations for the lenses. All right? You figure out what the image distance is. Then subtract that from the distance here. That gives you a new object distance to plug in for this focal length. Okay? And then you see what you get. In this particular case, the image is between the focal length of the second lens and the second lens. And we know now we should have a feeling for what kinds of images are produced by our mirrors and lenses. So I can ask you general questions about those, so that you should be able to tell me, okay, whether you think the images are real, virtual, erect, inverted, larger, smaller, etc. So in this case, if I have an object between the focal point and the lens, it's going to be give me a virtual image. Right? So this is real from the first lens, but it becomes virtual from the second. Now the idea of this system, it's sort of like a telescope, except my object isn't very far. Usually for a telescope, your object is far away. Okay, it comes in, it goes through, produces an image inside the telescope, and then what you do is you use this as an eyepiece. That's called the objective because it's near the object. Objective. Object. Okay, and the eyepiece, of course, is near the eye. And what the eyepiece is a magnifying glass. It takes the image that it's looking at it and magnifies it. Okay, so that's a very simple refracting telescope that's sitting there. Okay, other things, we talked a little bit about the human eye. Okay, we don't have to know all parts of the human eye, though you probably do, the many biologists that we have in the class. But we should know what near points and far points, nearsightedness, farsightedness, how to correct for those, how to get an idea of what kind of lens, for example, for farsighted, okay, what kind of focal length we'll need for correcting the vision. So those are a couple of the things that we have. Now I haven't gone into a whole lot of detail on some of these areas. Now if you come out, if you go to virtual optics bench, for example, you can actually come in and start playing with some of these things. Which of these lights? Lots of times these project things have their own colors, so it's hard to see sometimes. But for this particular app, you can actually take and stick a lens in here. Okay, and then I can go up and get an object, or I could get a source. I could get a beam. Here's a beam. Okay, and you can move things around. Okay, and see what's happening. So what's this point right here? Focal point. Good. Very clear. So I can put an object in here, say over there, and watch what happens. Okay. Right now it's real. I come in. Okay, you can see how all of a sudden this comes from behind. But at some point here it becomes virtual. You know when that is. And then I could put another lens in here, or actually I could put a mirror in there. So here's a mirror. Now I've got a lens and a mirror system. Okay, same kind of thing with two lenses. What I can do is have this lens produce an image, and then take that image and treat it as an object for the mirror. got, we didn't have concave mirrors, or let's see. Trying to get that to become complex. Okay, so there's all kinds of little things to do to refresh, think about this. Okay. There are different kinds of optical instruments, as I've noted. Okay, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail at this point on the optical instruments, though you could imagine I could easily do some of that. So starting off, the eyepiece, as I mentioned, in a telescope or in a microscope is really a magnifier. If you take a magnifying glass, all that is a lens, nothing fancy, and you have your printed stuff, that's the object, and what you do is you look into it and you want it to magnify it, okay? And so that's precisely what it's doing. What I have is my object here, and what you have to do is have the object, and they don't show it in this diagram. The object has to be between the lens and focal point, just like I did on the telescope, okay? And we can talk about magnification. The book talks about angular magnification, and the angular magnification is, if I just look at the height of an object, I could look at the angle that the top, the line going from the top of the object to the eye makes to the horizontal. Though if I insert a magnifying glass, I'm not looking at the angle with the object. What I'm doing is looking at the angle that the image makes, what I'm looking, actually looking at through the lens. And if that angle increases, then I have a magnification greater than 1. So you can talk about angular magnification and use those to compute magnification properties of optical instruments. But again, the whole point of this magnifying glass is it's a converging lens, but you bring the object between the focal point and the lens. That creates a virtual image, and that virtual image is larger. Okay, and you can see that when you actually take a converging lens and put it over some print. Okay, then you have various types of telescopes. Again, just reiterating, we don't really need to look at the whole eyeball here. Okay, so we have the eyepiece, we have the objective, the light comes from a distance, okay, produces the image just like I have in that diagram. So that's the basic idea of a refracting telescope. So you guys like microscopes. But it's pretty much the same idea. You're looking down here at some object. You've got the objective pretty close to it now, not some faraway object. And this goes and it produces an image, and then what you have to do is make sure the focal point's located just right. You can adjust that by adjusting the distance between the lenses. Okay, and again, you're looking through the eyepiece, which is a magnifying glass again. Okay, so this idea of a magnifying glass keeps coming up. And one can actually go through and look at the various types of magnifications and put them together and get the overall magnification of the instrument. What they don't show here is, well, this might be similar in some ways. Here's a simple telephoto lens, in which case we have a few lenses coming in here, and then that's just a mirror that reflects into a prism. And there we're looking in here. So. But for a reflecting telescope, which is this one, the idea is that you have this case, the light comes in from a distance. Okay, and instead of lenses, you have a mirror. So, as the light comes in, from a distance, what's it going to do? Reflect to where? Near the focal point. Okay, and so what I can do is put a little mirror in there, have that mirror reflect the light down here, and then I can put in an eyepiece down there, and I can look at the eyepiece, right? I can put in, my eyepiece is down here. And these tend to be shorter, okay, than the refracting telescopes. All right. So those are some ideas of some optical instruments. And that's pretty much how the chapter ends, is a discussion of some optical instruments and whatnot. Okay, so the last two chapters is what one we call geometric optics for the most part. So for one little point where we talked about rainbows, okay, we didn't have to worry too much about what type of electromagnetic wave we had, what color it was, whether it was an X-ray, a radio wave, etc. Okay? In the next chapter, we are going to look at what's called interference. Okay, and this is a property of the idea that light behaves as a wave, in which case the wavelength is going to start to play some role. Let's see. Now, before I get to writing too much stuff on the board about this, okay, one of the things the book assumes, or the authors of the book, right, is that you've read chapter 17. When you read chapter 17, you've read chapter 16. Okay, we can get away a little bit without having to go all the way back, but if you want to go back and look at what they say there, there are some similar things that are discussed in that chapter, but in regards to sound waves. So chapters 16 and 17 talk about sound waves and talk about this idea of the principle of linear superposition. Principle of linear superposition. Okay, so the idea back in chapter 17 was that if I had two speakers and I sent out the same tones from those speakers and I walked around the room, I might find some dead spots, I might find some spots where those waves sound louder. Now, in the case of light waves, instead of things being louder, they'd be brighter or higher amplitude waves. Okay, so there's a connection between the other waves, except electromagnetic waves are transverse and sound waves are longitudinal. But other than that, the mathematical description that we use is pretty much the same. And so you learn what this means, and what the principle of linear superposition means is that if I have a point here and I have one wave coming in this direction, I have another wave coming in that direction, I'd like to know what happens at that point when there's more than one wave trying to occupy that space. Okay? And the idea is that they do add. Okay? They superimpose. Okay? And they do it linearly, which means that the sum is equal to the sum of the individual waves. Okay? And now this can have some consequences. We can do the same thing for light, okay, and look at the superposition of waves. So you can see in here, and this is a little animation even, okay, that you have two waves. A green wave is going that way, a blue wave is going this way, and the sum is black, okay, and as they're going. Okay, and doing that, actually what this represents, okay, are waves, for example, on a string, and you did a lab in this, most likely. Okay, once you had some string and you had a little oscillator that was oscillating and it was tied down at one end, you put some tension in it and you noticed various points along that didn't move, and then the rest in between the points went up and down and up and down. Well, that's what that black thing is doing, right? Those are standing waves. Okay. That's coming from the superposition of two waves. One wave is going this way, the other wave is coming that, right? The oscillator sends a wave out, goes up to the pulley, and it bounces back, it reflects. The reflective wave interferes now with the incoming wave, and they produce this wave. And if it's done just right, you get a standing wave. Okay, so those are some of the ideas that come in to our thoughts, except it's a little easier to see the vibrating string than it is to see a vibrating electromagnetic wave. That was vibrating so fast, number one. Okay, in terms of electromagnetic waves, you go back to the electric field that's contributing, right? What you do is you have two electromagnetic waves coming to a point. Really, what, right, we've sent electromagnetic energy. We see the electric field changing at that point due to both waves. So the total change is the sum of the electric field. Okay, and then the brightness has to do with the square of the amplitude of the electric field. So there are all kinds of things we can do to have interfering waves. Like I said, it doesn't just have to be electromagnetic waves. So here are two pulses that come together. Boom. They can form. You can see as these guys come together, the individual wave underneath. Okay, one's going this way, one's coming that way, but right as they pass through, they have an interaction. Okay. So here's more examples. Okay, let's see. This one's just sitting there, that's passing by, showing what happens when you have two waves come together, either when the peaks line up or when the peaks are completely opposite. The one peak lines up with the valley on the other one. Okay, and then we get to see at each separate instant what that particular superposition is. So those are the types of things that we can think about. Obviously, you can get some really complicated stuff, and don't let the equations scare you too much. We're not going to. Right, that's 202. Okay, in 202, we'll write all that out. In this class, we won't write down the actual mathematical representation, but we all know that these are sine waves for, you know, a particular one wavelength. So if I have two waves coming together, right, I just have to add a couple of sine functions and play around with some trig and see what I get. And then I go to something like Maple or whatever, a graphing calculator, and plot it. If I have two waves that are very close to each other, okay, in wavelength, then we can get something that looks like it's got this overall pattern. We end up with, in terms of sound, we end up with beats, okay, in which we have these two signals. Okay, if you're tuning a piano, for example, and, right, the idea is that you have the tones slightly different, you can actually hear this beat, and that's how you tune it, and you do that until you get rid of that beat. And that's how you tone it, if you have a good ear, of course. Idea sitting there. Now, in this particular chapter, we're going to be looking at a couple of different types of results of this interference. One of them is the so-called double slit experiment, which I'll describe in a couple minutes. Okay. And the idea is that in a double slit, we send some light through these two slits of the same wavelength. It comes out, and I basically have two beams coming out. and these act as two point sources. And I look at and see what types of patterns come out. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be just light rays. These could be water waves. Okay? Or these could be two bugs sitting there on top of the surface of some still water, each one of them producing ripples of waves, right? And then the sum of the ripples produce these patterns where you're going to have bright spots and dark spots. So I can put a screen here or some detectors along there, and I will detect places where, in this case, it could be water calmer here than it is there, right? We have bigger deeps there. So we can look for these patterns in terms of, we can do this in terms of sound waves, in which case those would be speakers, or we could go to the double slit experiment to show that basically that's the first indication that light is a wave because it exhibits properties of superposition which and diffraction and whatnot, which only happen with things that behave like waves. All right, so let me write a few things down. So those are just pretty pictures. So that's superposition. So let's say that I have two sources of, say, electromagnetic waves, right? So we have electromagnetic waves coming out in all directions here, and let's say that I am going to make an observation at that point. I see some electromagnetic waves starting off here. As I go off in that direction. So before, I was paying attention to light rays, right? I didn't care about the wavelength, right? That was when I was doing geometric optics. Now we have a wavelength, and so remember the wavelength is the distance between peaks represented by lambda measured in units of length. And I'm interested in making an observation at that point. Now let's assume that the light ray that's coming out of this one has the same wavelength, the same amplitude, and that they're in phase. Phase mean?
Peaks right at the same time.
Right? They go through zero at the same time, they peak at the same time. Right? So they both started at the same point, and then they're going up, and then of course I'm going down. I'm following the one that's going this direction. And while I'm sitting at point P, I see these two rays come in. Right, one of them's coming in and it's doing this, oscillating, and then the other one's coming in and it's doing that, except they may not come in phase. Do you believe that?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I said it.
No, because the distance is not the same.
Because the distance isn't the same. So the distance from here to here is not the same as the distance from there to there. So what does that mean?
That the wave might be different. The
part of the wave. All right, so let's see. Obviously, this is not done very neatly. Right? I could have been a little cleaner here, but let's assume that I did that neatly. Let's see. How many wavelengths do I have in the top one? One, roughly, anyway. Two, three, But it depends on that last little bit where I end up, right? When I get to that point. So these could differ when they get there. And that matters. So the question is, what kind of possibilities do I have? So the first possibility I have is that I'm sitting there at the point and I'm looking at this wave going up and down, and now I'm thinking about this oscillating in time at that point. So at that fixed location, the first wave could go that. Maybe I'll call that wave A, wave B. This would be wave A. Now I have all kinds of possibilities for what wave B is doing. Let's assume that this comes in and they are in phase. Okay, well, if they're not in phase here, I might be able to move around here and change these distances in such a way, okay, that they, at some point they're in phase. So what happens when I add these two together? Well, mathematically, how do I add functions? Okay, I come along and I add them point by point. So we come along here, roughly, that's 0 plus 0 is 0. And then I come over, and if I did this right, that they're in phase, then the peak's going to add, and that's going to be twice the amplitude. And then it goes through 0 when they're both 0. And then it goes down, and we get something like that, 2 times the amplitude. That's assuming, again, that they have equal amplitudes. Okay? So what does that tell me about the light?
Greater intensity.
Greater intensity. Brighter. Okay? So this is brighter. Now, for this to happen, and this is called constructive interference, again, this is done also for sound waves in chapter 17. So for constructive interference, these things are going to be in phase. What does that tell me about the distance, the difference between the distances here? So let's say that the distance that the first wave travels to get to P is L1, and the distance that the second wave travels is L2. So then the path difference is difference between the two of these. Of course, in general, I don't know what that is, so I'm just going to take the absolute value, throw away the negative signs. I don't care about that right now. So the path difference between the two of these has to be what? Or what could it be? Any examples? Why would these line up?
When it's the same distance.
When it's the same. Okay? Is that the only way this will line, they'll line up? Do I have to have the same number of wavelengths here as I have there?
No.
What could I add to it?
A wavelength.
I could add another wavelength. If I add another wavelength, then I'll be in the same place on the wave, right? So the difference here could be a wavelength. Is everybody with me? Is that all? What?
Multiple.
Multiple. You mean like two wavelengths? three wavelengths, four wavelengths, et cetera. If I took away the absolute value, it could be put in plus minus. But the point is that if the distance difference between the two of these is a multiple of a wavelength, I can put in a whole wavelength in there, and I would end up with constructive interference. So this turns out to be the criteria for constructive interference is delta L is a multiple of the wavelength, where M is an integer. Of course, there are many, many other ways these waves can combine. Anything else is not constructive interference. And the sum of what I get is going to be a lot smaller than twice. So that's the maximum I can get, the brightest I can get. Another possibility is I can take wave A. Let's say that's the same basic shape. But when wave B comes in, it'll be completely out of phase. Meaning, instead of peaking when A peaks, it's going to bottom out. And then it's going to go to zero. And then it's going to peak. Then it's going to come down and up. Where these are meant to be the same amplitude, they're meant to go through zero at the same time, but they don't peak at the same time, so they're not in phase. And then the question is, what do I get when I add those? Well, zero plus zero is zero. And I come along here, and that's, say, plus, I don't know, 3/4 of the height. And this is going to be minus 3/4 of the height. Therefore, it's going to add to
zero.
And I keep adding these, and I get
zero.
So it's flatlined. What does that mean as far as the light?
It's dark.
It's dark. Can't see anything. So, when will this happen? Okay, what can you tell me here about the path difference? How could I make these? Well, let's see. How are these related? What's the difference between these two?
Half a wavelength.
They're off by half a wavelength, right? So there's a half a cycle. All right, if I brought this over a little bit, right, they're half a cycle off. And so if the path difference is a half a wavelength, which means that both pretty much this goes through, let's say this one went through 5 exactly, this one would go through 5.5. Okay, then I get that kind of scenario. Is that the only way I'm going to get these to cancel? Because what I can do now is take this, and I can now shift it by a wavelength. So if I keep shifting that by a wavelength, okay, or multiple wavelengths, okay, as long as I have that starting 1/2 of a wavelength, adding full wavelengths to that, it's going to give me this picture again. So that's the condition for what's called destructive interference. But we can investigate that. Or completely destructive interference. Sometimes this condition is written where the lambda is factored out as m plus 1/2 times lambda. And m, of course, can be 0, 1, 2. All right, so these are some key ingredients, okay, that we need. One of the things is that I really only looked at this for one instant, this wave's coming out from here. What I want is that these sources need to continually be in phase, okay, not just at the one instant. And so what I'm also going to assume is that I have coherent sources. All right, so these two sources are in phase, all right, for all time. Okay, I can do that with a laser, but these lights, the fluorescent lights, light bulbs, whatnot, I can't take two light bulbs and do this setup. All right, so I have to set things up so I have nice coherent sources. And most of these things we're going to do is we're going to look at monochromatic light. What does monochromatic mean? One color or one wavelength. Corresponding colors. Okay. All right, there's a famous experiment from, I think it was 1801, Young's double slit experiment. Which is, I guess, kind of amazing because back in the 1800s, we didn't have lasers. Right? Of course, in the lab, you're using lasers to do some of these things. Okay, so the idea of this experiment is that you have some light that comes in through what are called double slits. I can think of a card like this, okay, in which I put through, and then that light comes out, and those act as two sources with the same wavelength. So we assume that the light that's coming through these slits, okay, you can imagine looking at this, the slit is cut across this way in my picture. And the light comes through here, and these act as little point sources or little sources of light. And now I can observe these types of behaviors like I did there, except typically what you do is you put a screen up. Okay. Now in the lab, there you don't do it actually a double slit, you do a multiple slit with the fraction grating. We'll talk about those later in the next class. But the idea is that we put a screen or something up here. We make an observation at some point P as to what happens. You look at these two rays. And we look to see whether we have constructive or destructive interference there. And that means we look for maxima and minima, the brightest spot and the darkest spot. What we get that shows up on here is what's called an interference pattern or interference fringes. And our job is to locate where the maxima and the minima are. Okay, from what we know. We assume the screen is pretty far away, so I could have put in that the screen is some distance L from the slits. These slits have a slit separation of D. So D is the distance between the two slits. And for what I'm doing right now, I'm thinking of them as very thin slits. They don't have any real dimension. Okay, in reality, we know they do. One can account for those. And you can see now that there is a path difference between the two of these. If this is far enough away, I can approximate the path difference, right? When I could take this, think of that as the center of a circle, and I could trace out a circular arc here and measure off that that's the same distance as this. There's my path difference right there. I can see it. All I have to do now is ask how many wavelengths fit in there. Okay, if I can get the number of wavelengths to be a multiple of the wavelength, an integer multiple of the wavelength, then I know I have constructive interference and I have a bright spot. Okay, or if it satisfies this relation, I get a dark spot. So that's really what's going on here. And it's a matter of figuring out what that path difference is. If the screen's far enough away, then what I could do is just approximate this. Instead of being an arc on a circle, I can approximate it by that chord on the circle. And so there's really an approximation that goes here. And this little, here's my delta L. My path. Once again, if we think of things as being fairly far away, like that, then I could look at the angle that the ray makes here called theta. This angle plus that angle is 90 degrees, but this angle and that angle is 90, so therefore theta up here, okay, is equal to theta down there, approximately. And now I have this triangle, so blowing up that triangle, I have the following picture. Theta, there's D, delta L, and if I look at that triangle, is there a way that I can relate delta L to D? Right, delta L is opposite, D is the hypotenuse, opposite over hypotenuse is, it's not going to be angle. Therefore, the path difference is just d sine theta. So the maxima bright spots are going to be when delta L is a multiple of lambda. Well, that just tells me d sine theta is a multiple of lambda. And my minima for dark spots get if d sine theta is m plus 1 half lambda. Well, that's good if I know what d is, right? But the question is, what's theta? I'm not going to go up and measure this. I don't even see it. Okay. But if things are far enough away, my setup really looks like the following. I have D is sitting there. The screen is over here. If I look directly from the center of the slits across, okay, and take that line, then it turns out P is approximately at an angle of theta to the horizontal. This line is approximately at an angle of theta to the horizontal. This angle at and that angle are approximately the same, as long as L is fairly big compared to the slit width. Okay? So, there's L, and this angle actually tells me where this is located. I could put this at a point Y. So if I know how far the bright spot, for example, is from the center, I can get this angle, put it in here, and I can measure the wavelength or something, right? Depends upon what I get. Now for different M values, I'm going to have various, well, let's see. So this could be M equals 1, M equals 2. If these are bright spots, M equals 0 is in the center. And I have some symmetry which says my M equals 1 and M equals 2 also give me spots on the other side of the center. So that's the picture I get. Or I can go and put the various values in here and determine, well, I have to see where these points are. So M equals 0, that's lambda over 2. That would be somewhere, and here's a dark spot, here's a dark spot. So I have bright, dark. Of course, in between the bright and the dark, I have various shades, okay, going through. So that's the basic layout for this type of a problem. So the keys are, am I looking for a bright location or a dark location? Okay, can I find where it is? So for example, given a separation distance, given a slit width, can I tell you where from the center, okay, one of these is, say, the first bright spot? All right, so locate. And then we can plug some numbers in. Let's see, 546 nanometers. Let's say that the distance is 55 centimeters. And D, the separation width, is 0.012 millimeters. Is small. Okay, so did everybody catch? We have an exam in a week, right? Monday, I'm going to be looking for a review session room for 5 to 7. Okay, and I'll report back. Okay, so how do I do this? Well, if I knew what theta were, I could figure out what y is. What I'm looking for is locate the, when I'm saying located, I'm saying how far, what value of y is on either side. So really, this is the one I'm looking for on either side, what that distance is. So what is y? Let's go through and see. So y equals blah. How do you determine y? From this picture. Don't worry about the numbers yet. What do I need to get y?
There's
y. There's L. There's a triangle. I need the opposite side of this can I get that with? What do I know? I know L. So is there anything that relates to L and Y? Tangent.
Okay, so first thing we know is the tangent of theta is equal to Y over L. This tells me that Y is equal to L tangent theta, which I compute if I compute theta. How do I get theta? Well, I want a bright spot, so at some point I'm going to need that. Okay, so we know that d sine theta is m lambda. What's m? 1. Okay, now when they talk about finding the third order spot of something, okay, then m is equal to 3. Okay, that will come up when you're doing diffraction gratings problems. And diffraction grating problems essentially just involve things that look like this. So you've seen that formula in lab, but we haven't gotten that part yet. It's similar. So this is equal to lambda. Okay, so now I can start thinking here. Sine theta is equal to lambda over d. Lambda over d is 546 nanometers. This is basically about 5.5 × 10⁻⁷ divided by something that's on the order of 10⁵, and I still have something that's relatively small. Okay, so typically in these problems, theta is small, or at least sine theta is small. And for small angles, sine theta is approximately theta, and tangent theta is approximately theta. And so therefore, sine theta is approximately tangent theta. So if sine theta is approximately tangent theta, what I could do is just take y over l and replace it for the sine. Okay? So I could take and say y over l is equal to lambda over d and solve for y. This is an approximation. Now, if you're not comfortable with that, we could just say, all right, sine theta is equal to lambda, which was 5.46 nanometers is 10⁻⁹. Take 100 away from the 500, that could be 10⁻⁷. Meters. So nanometers goes, right, wavelengths for visible light typically goes like 10⁻⁷ meters. And then 0.12 millimeters, that's 1.2 × 10⁻², times 10⁻³ for the millimeters, meters. So what do I get? 5.46 over 1.2 times 10⁻². So what's 5.46 over 1.2? All right, what's the inverse sine of that? Well, if I did this in radians, the inverse sine is this. So when you do this approximation, you have to be in radians. Okay. But we go through, you can get theta, and you get some number, and then you take the tangent of that, and what do you get? You get this. Is exactly that. Okay. All right, so take the inverse sine, take the tangent of that answer, and that is the same. So that just confirms what I was saying back here.
Now I can take the tangent of theta and multiply it by L, so y, I'm getting a little low here, so let me do it up. Almost done. Y is equal to L tan theta. L is 55 centimeters, so 55 centimeters times this number. But you get 2.5 times, you just got 2.5 centimeters. Is that what you got? 55 centimeters times this. All right, so that tells me 2.5 centimeters up or down or below. Okay. Notice I have to have really narrow slits in order to get these things to separate enough that I can see, right? 2.5 centimeters I can see, but that's only about an inch. You're not getting 2.5, Noah?
So it's not. It's still 2.5, but it's like the negative 5. Maybe I just put it in off.
Yeah. Because I have 2×10⁻². So that's point.
I think I'll just get meters.
That's 0.0455 times 55. So I'm not going to get 10⁻¹.
I'll just get it in meters.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's the other thing. I left it in centimeters. Easy to do. All right, so that's just one kind of interference. Though that's historically a major interference. Once Young did this experiment, we knew that light has features of waves. Okay? Even long before things like quantum mechanics, things like Maxwell coming up, or it was 60 years later that Maxwell actually derived the wave equation. There are other kinds of interference problems. And another neat type of interference problem has to do with what's called thin film interference. Puddles on the ground, then you see little colors coming off the puddles, right? And sometimes those colors, not all the colors are there. And so we end up seeing some interference types of patterns. All right, so for thin film interference, you basically, you have a thin film. Okay, so there's all kinds of types of ways we can have thin films. Okay, so in that particular case, I could have some water that's sitting here. So there's a little bit of water. Of course, we've got the ground underneath. It's not just the water. Okay, though this could be, a BP oil spill. We have some water, and then we have a thin film, which means we have a layer. Now, my thin film's going to look a little thick, so I can actually see something. Okay, but there's my thin film. This could be maybe some gas or oil or something. Okay. And then above that, we have air. So instead of just having the air and the water, now I've got a little thin film sitting on top of it. And the claim is that we can get some interference. And the way this happens is, when you're looking down, All right, that's some light that's coming down. We're going to assume this. I'm going to draw it slightly, not directly into coming down the normal. Okay, but it's almost normal incidence. So you have this light ray that comes down. And what does the light ray do? Well, one thing it does is it reflects. So we can see that reflection. But it can also refract, which means some of the light can come in and it can bend and then reflect off the next surface and then refract out. And now we have two light rays coming through. We can focus on the wavelength. Okay, so we'll assume that this light, we're just looking at one wavelength of some light that's coming through. And what's going to happen is it's going to come out and there's going to be interference. All right, so this is a standard kind of an example. Air has an index of refraction of 1. Water has an index of refraction of, say, 1.33. All right, and then I didn't write down the gas because I wasn't actually going to do that problem. But. Oh, maybe I did write it down. This is 1.4. All right. So there could be different types. There's another problem I wanted to do. I thought I'd write this down. Okay. But anyway, there is what's going on. Now, I could look at more. All right, but this is getting pretty dilute in terms of, you know, not much is going to come back up, maybe. But that's enough to focus on. I just have two rays that are coming together. Okay. And now we're going to look at the fact that there could be some interference. One thing that could happen is that these two rays that are coming up could come and constructively interfere. Which means what? For that particular wavelength, it's going to be brighter. And we'll see that wavelength. Or these two could come together and be destructive, in which case that color will not show up when I'm looking at that location. Okay? So, that's the first thing. Interference. In order to determine whether these combined or not, right? I could have that there is a path difference that's going to lead to constructive or destructive interference. Well, let's see. Is there a path difference? Well, the idea is that the path difference really is taking place in the film. So there's a path difference in the film. Okay, if I let T be thickness, then how much further has the second ray traveled than the first one? 2T. Okay. So, this is my path difference. That's going to contribute to the interference. And you would think the story is done now, because now I know what the path difference is. I could relate the thickness to the film now to whether I get constructive or destructive interference for a particular wavelength. Right? Well, unfortunately, that's not the final story. There's one more contribution that goes into determining exactly what's going on. And this has to do with how the light reflects from the surface. Now, this all comes out if you do some sophisticated mathematics. We're going to have to do just a simple analogy. So instead of looking at light, let's consider the following. I'm going to take a rope, and I'm going to tie it to a pole. Okay, and then I'm going to pull on it. I'm going to go like this, and I'm going to cause a pulse. So we're going to have a pulse that I send down the rope like that. So actually, I'm standing on this side. All right, so I go like this. That pulse comes along. And what happens when it comes over here? Well, it's this rope starts yanking on the pole, but the pole says, nope. It's going to say, I'm not going to budge. So what happens to this wave when it comes back?
It's backing upside down.
Mm-hmm.
It's like reversing upside down.
It comes back upside down. It flips upside down. You have to do the experiment, and then you have to wonder why this has anything to do with electromagnetic waves. Okay? So this is a subtle thing. So what happens here is that I get a phase shift. Right? It gets shifted by half a wavelength. That's the same thing that happens to some reflections. If N1 is less than N2, then we have a shift. Okay, so there's a phase shift. Of course, I'm not going to measure it in terms of angles, so I'm going to measure it in terms of wavelengths. So we're going to have a shift of a half a wavelength. Now it turns out that if I instead tied this rope to a little ring, so that ring was free to move, then when this came through, that ring would go up with it and down with it, and it would send it back, not shift it. So if N1 is greater than N2, or N2 is less than N1, then the shift is zero. Okay? So for studying this problem, the basic idea, and here are the pieces. I have a difference between these two due to the path difference. Before, we would have said if the path difference is equal to a multiple of lambda, then I would have complete destruction. However, I have two shifts. I have a shift here possible, and I have a shift here possible. So depending upon if I go from a lower to a higher, or a higher to a lower, I have to add into the equation another half a wavelength. Okay, those are the pieces that go into determining what kind of interference I have. Okay, so those are the ingredients, and what we're going to do in the next class is put those together. Right, I'm not going to write down an equation that you have to memorize, right? We have all the details here. We just have to piece some things together. Think about the two things here, basically twice the thickness, and then look at the shift, put that together, and then decide, depending if I want constructive or destructive interference, what kind of thickness